day in Aussie, and seen probably more than some of us have around Sydney for a long time. The only time you see things in places like Sydney when you're a resident is when you're showing someone around. And then you start reminding yourself of things that you should know about or haven't seen for years and years. Okay, let's take our hymnals and let's all sing out. If you want to move off those back tables and come and sit down on a normal seat, would be nice. Looks like it's the peanut gallery back there and the more converted ones down the front. I'll tell you what, I'm glad I'm not speaking. This light up there is really... it's great for you, you can see me, but it's just knocking my eyes out completely. Okay, number 11 we'll start with. Blessed is the nation God is for. We all should know that one. Everyone please rise.
Is the nation God is for, and the people he has chosen. For God looked down from heaven above, and he beholds all nations. From his place above he looks on all, he sees their every doing. He sees their sin, he sees their works, he beholds all of those who fear him. O you righteous in the Lord, rejoice, songs of praise befit the upright. Play skillfully upon the string, sing to him a joyful new song. For the word of God is right and just, all his works are true and faithful. His loving kindness fills the earth, for he loves righteousness and justice. By the word of God the heavens were made, waters by the sea he gathered. In storage places laid the deeps, let all the earth revere him. Let the people stand in awe of him, for he spoke and earth existed. When he commanded, it stood fast, by his word were the heavens created. Kings will not be saved by armies great, nor a mighty man delivered. Not one is saved by his own strength, nor by some other power. But the eyes of God are on the just, those who fear and worship him, who wait for him, who hope for him, those who trust in the God of Israel.
Not too bad. I can almost hear you. I hope you can't hear me. It's not a good thing. Number 29 now. Number 29. Praise the Eternal with a psalm, which is from Psalm 81.
Praise the Eternal with a psalm, sing to the God of Jacob. Raise the chorus, make a joyful noise, bring out the harp and timbrel. Blow on the trumpet, sound the drum, on a solemn feast day. This is a statute and a law which God has ordained for Israel. Hear, O my people, hear my voice. I will admonish Israel. You shall have no other foreign gods. I am the God who freed you. When you were troubled, you did call. I delivered Israel. God answered in the secret place. With thunder he did command them. I am the God who brought you the land of Egypt. Hear, O Israel, open wide your mouth, I surely will fulfill it. But Israel would not heed God, they would have their own ways. Oh, if they only had obeyed, then God would have surely freed them. Praise the Eternal with a psalm, sing to the God of Jacob. Raise the chorus, make a joyful noise, bring out the harp and timbrel. Blow on the trumpet, sound the drum, on a solemn feast days. This is a statute and a law which God has ordained for Israel.
I just killed the mic, excuse me. I knew I was going to do that. I could see this thing very close to my hands, and I knew I was going to whack it. So I'll step back from it next time. Okay, we'll have another hymn in this first part of the service. We'll turn to number 33, and after this we'll be led in the opening prayer by a member from Canberra, who is also a member of our United Church of God's National Finance Committee to help with the overall governance of our finances, Peter King.
Be not afraid, be not afraid, my people.
Peter King.
Great God of heaven and earth, we thank you so much for all that you give us. We are very blessed in all that we have, and we ask your blessing today on this service. We pray that your Spirit will be with us, that it will guide us and help us to take in the information which you wish us to learn and to grow from it. We thank you for all that you give, and we ask your blessing now on this service and on all those who are unable to be with us. We pray this blessing now through your Son Jesus' name. Amen.
The service today we run as a normal service in the morning, and it'll be more of a lecture style this afternoon. So for the first message this morning, we have a member from Sydney, Murray Allett.
Good morning, brethren and folks. Just organised a pile of paper I've managed to acquire. I've never quite mastered the art of cutting things down to the minimum. Now, 30 years ago or thereabouts, I received this book in the post, having listened to a radio program, and within about a few weeks of having read the book, and particularly in having got to chapter 7, I had concluded that the Sabbath was to be kept. I had concluded that the Bible prophecy was important, but not only that, it was understandable. And this book, The United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy, which was written by Herbert Armstrong, was a book that led me into this church and into the truth, and no doubt many, many of you. That book, some years ago, after Mr. Armstrong's death, was withdrawn from circulation. I actually didn't find that out till about 3 years after the occurrence. I'm always someone to find out things the last. And when I did find it out, the explanations that were thrown up had to do with, well, it's cultist, it's elitist, the Israelitish identity is unprovable, and we really need to do an awful lot more work on it. Well, that was a message that I got about why the book was withdrawn, which I didn't appreciate at the time, but like many of you, many of the other messages we got from Worldwide Church of God at the time, they were messages that we didn't agree with, but we stayed around in the hope that some things would change. Well, some things don't change for some people. And what really occurred over a number of years incrementally was a lot of people changed their views on various things. One of those areas was prophecy. What we got in due course was the abhorrence of so-called prediction addiction, which I think impacted a lot of people and has really led many people to take a view of prophecy which is something less than they should. An example of this, which I want to refer to, this is just before I get to the main short point of this message, I want to read to you just some extracts of a letter that was in a newspaper called The Journal a few weeks ago. And I'm not going to identify the writer or what essentially it was about, but you can pick it up probably from the small bit that I do read out as to what the point about it is. What the person says, and he's talking about another organisation, and I don't need to go into that, but what he says is that if you look at our long-published statement of beliefs, you will notice that each of our listed teachings is upheld powerfully. We've worked hard to be defenders of the faith, and we are working hard to be teachers of the faith. How can we be criticised for teaching biblical truths minus unbiblical end-time speculation? He goes on to say, I've heard for years that Jesus continually spoke about earthquakes, famines and disease epidemics, but I just don't see it. I find them in precious few verses in three parallel accounts, and he doesn't even stress them. Instead, he said not to be troubled. Now, the point I want to make about that is that it is true that Jesus himself spoke relatively sparing of these things while he was here on earth. But what that kind of attitude ignores and even perhaps denies is that the prophecies of the Old Testament were inspired. Indeed, they were the messages from Jesus Christ in his role as the God of the Old Testament. He didn't need to laboriously repeat these things. He didn't need to go over the Old Testament and have it all dutifully recorded in the New Testament. He'd already said it. And he'd said it in prophecies like in Ezekiel and in Jeremiah and the other prophets about the end times. So what we find with attitudes towards prophecy like that is that many people, I think, have become not disenchanted with prophecy so much as they just don't think it's important. They see that Jesus Christ, in his human form, spoke more about relationships, perhaps is the way they see it, spoke more about our relationships with God and our individual personal situation, and perhaps didn't focus on prophecy. But he only had to do it once in Matthew and the other parallel scriptures. The disciples asked the question, what's the sign of your coming? When will it be? And he gave them a forthright answer. I want to just quickly go to another article, which I can identify, and just refer to that briefly, because I don't think I can claim to have great original thoughts, but this particular quote here struck me. This is an article by a fellow called Rex Sexton. It deals with prophecy. And he actually deals with this issue of the Olivet Prophecy. He says, the crucially important Olivet Prophecy, recorded in Matthew 24, was given by Christ in answer to the question, what will be the sign of your coming and at the end of the age? He refers to verse 3, and the disciples wanted to know about the events that would herald the second coming of Christ to establish his kingdom here on the earth. Jesus warned his disciples several times not to lose their sense of urgency about his coming. He said to stay alert and always be ready. For we don't know the exact hour of his return. Sorry. He goes on to recount that later in Matthew 24, there's the story of the servants. The blessed servant is one who is faithful and wise, giving proper food, spiritual instruction at the right time. In other words, the wise servant heeds Jesus' lesson of a fig tree, recognises that Christ's return is near at the very doors. The evil servant, on the other hand, says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards. The evil servant's disregard for prophecy leads him to abuse others and neglect his own spiritual growth. And who are the drunkards, this writer asks. What did Christ mean by saying the evil servant could drink with them? Some of Jesus' servants have strayed and literally caroused with ungodly men, But Christ's warning can also have a spiritual dimension. It goes on to say, spiritual drunkenness is following this world's false religious systems, the system described as the great harlot, which leads to an important lesson, and this is the point, losing sight of the importance of Bible prophecy and the urgency of Christ's return leads to false religion. Now, leading on from that, I want to turn to the Ezekiel, what's been termed the Ezekiel warning message. Ezekiel was a prophet of God who, when he received the prophecies that are recorded, was in captivity with the house of Judah. And at that time, the house of Israel had long since departed from the scene, having been the subject of a captivity about 120 years prior to the captivity of Judah. Now, there's some people that have some doubts about this business about the house of Judah and the house of Israel. That split came after the death of Solomon, when there was a dispute between the northern 10 tribes and the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. We read about that in 1 Kings 12:16. If you'd like to turn there. It says, so when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, the people answered the king, saying, this is Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, what portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, now see to your own house, David. So Israel departed unto their tents. But as for the children of Israel, which dwelt in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. It goes on to point out that only Judah and Benjamin and the Levites remained with Judah. And what we see in verse 21 is that the house of Judah and the house of Israel actually went to war. Quite clearly, they were distinct entities at that time. Now, Ezekiel was told by God in Ezekiel verses 3, 1, first of all, Ezekiel 3 and verse 1. Moreover, he said to me, son of man, eat. And unfortunately, I've only got a King James version, so the language is a bit messy for me as well. Thou art, eat that thou findest, eat this roll, and go speak unto the house of Israel. In a better translation, well, it simply says, go speak to the house of Israel. In Ezekiel 3:4, Ezekiel is told, and he said unto me, son of man, go get thee unto the house of Israel, and speak my words unto them. Now, the point that Herbert Armstrong brought out in that book, which was among many points that were telling for me, was that he was able to demonstrate, and I was convinced of what he said, that Ezekiel had no way physically of speaking to Israel. They had gone. They had been physically removed, so that the prophecy of Ezekiel had to be for some later time. Now, if there's any doubt that people might have of Ezekiel's understanding between the difference between the house of Judah and the house of Israel, we only need to go to Ezekiel 4 to see that Ezekiel would have been under no illusion whatever as to which was which. In Ezekiel chapter 4, God tells Ezekiel to lie down on one side for a number of days, and on another side for another number of days. What he says is, for I have laid upon you the years of their iniquity according to the number of the days, 390 days, so shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. In the next verse, Ezekiel is told to lie on his side for 40 days to bear the iniquity of the house of Judah. Having done that, it could not be thought that Ezekiel would be under any doubt that he was speaking to the house of Israel, or his prophecy was the house of Israel, with whom he was not at that time. Now, further in Ezekiel 4, in chapter 3 in verse 17, Ezekiel's made a watchman under the house of Israel. In other words, he's made, the prophecy is given to him as a watch, as a warning. And he's, without going through the scriptures, through the verses, he's told, in effect, that a watchman has a responsibility to watch. And if the danger comes upon the people and the watchman hasn't warned them, then their blood will be upon his head. And so again, Ezekiel, not being able himself to go to the house of Israel, has left this message for some other time, for some other person or some other people to take the message to the house of Israel. That watchman's message is again given in Ezekiel 33:7. And again it says, "So thou art son of man, I have set thee a watchman under the house of Israel, therefore you shall hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me." Mr. Armstrong used to speak in terms of scriptures being repeated in order to give emphasis. I remember one in particular, "The soul that sinneth, it shall die," repeated twice, and Mr. Armstrong pointed that out as a point of emphasis. Here we have Ezekiel being told twice that he was a watchman and that he had a message to deliver to the house of Israel. Now we learn from the prophet Daniel in Daniel 12:8-9 that Daniel's prophecy of end times was sealed up until the end. And at the end time, God told Daniel that the wise would understand, but the evil would not. It's not surprising that Ezekiel's prophecy also is disclosed at the end of the age. In Daniel 12:7, I noticed in passing the scripture reads that the end time will also be a time when the power of the holy people will be scattered. Now that just seems to touch on a nerve as to what has happened within the churches of God over this last time, over these last few years. It's not meant to intend that things are all about to fold up, but these scriptures we ought to pay account to, that things are getting to a climax eventually. Today is one day closer to the end of the age than yesterday was. And we need to keep that urgency about us and keep that in mind. The crux of the Ezekiel warning is contained in chapters 5 and 6 of Ezekiel. I only want to refer to a couple of them because they give emphasis as to what the warning is about. In Ezekiel chapter 5 and verse 8, God tells Ezekiel to tell the people, "Behold, I am against you and will execute judgments in the midst of you, in the sight of the nations, and I will do in thee that which I have not done, and whereunto I will not do any more the like because of all your abominations." Now, without going through, if I can just refer you to verse 12 as well, which refers to the third part of Israel dying of pestilence, a third of famine, and a third by the sword, and a third being taken captive. Over in Ezekiel chapter 6 and verse 11, again, God inspires Daniel to write, so there's no doubt as to whom he's speaking to. "Thus saith the Lord God, smite with thine hand and stamp with thy foot and say, alas, for all the evil abominations of the house of Israel, for they shall fall by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence." Now that hones in the chapters 5 and 6 and a little bit beyond that as being relevant to the house of Israel. Now, Jesus Christ instructed his disciples to preach the gospel of the kingdom to all the world as a witness. The gospel is the gospel of the kingdom of God. It is not a gospel of fear, a gospel of tribulation. I should say that I'm aware that at least one person who saw the latest cover of the Good News magazine said to one member of the church, "Oh, I see you're still preaching the gospel of fear." And that's from a former associate of the church. Now, of course, that's just not true. It is a message of warning, and the Good News magazine quite rightly is raising these issues of concern right at the end of this age. How do we know that it is really the right at the end of this age? Again, Mr. Armstrong properly identified the means by which we know that. In Matthew 24:22, Christ said in that Olivet prophecy, "Had not those days been cut short, not a soul would be saved alive. However, for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short." Of course, we know that it was only with the advent of the atomic age that such a scenario could have been brought to notice, could have become evident. And though the waning of the conflict or the Cold War between the United States, Europe and Russia has waned as well over the last few years, we know even in the last few weeks that India and Pakistan have joined the club. We know that Iraq has access to absolutely incredible biological weapons. And of course, that's one of the things that the Good News magazine touched on recently by way of reference to the resurgence of bacterial diseases and the like. And some of you might have seen an article in the Good Weekend magazine last weekend, published from the Sydney Morning Herald, which devoted a substantial article to the development by countries like Russia, no doubt America, of biological weapons, the kind of thing that you can drop from a plane, and the great invention of it all has been you drop it and the dust particles are designed to explode apart so that almost instantaneously the trail of dust that you can see being dropped from the plane disappears before your eyes as it's blown on the wind carrying anthrax and the like. Now, these things are real. The end of the age can be dated at least from the advent of the atomic age. Let me just refer back to Ezekiel 5:8-9, where Ezekiel records God saying, "I will inflict punishment upon you before the eyes of the nations," and he's speaking of the house of Israel, "and do to you what I have never done before, a thing I will never do again, owing to all your detestable deeds." Can we imagine that between the time Ezekiel wrote that and now, that God has done something to Israel that he will never do again? I don't think so. We haven't seen in history the house of Israel cut down a third by famine, a third by the sword, and a third going into captivity. The Ezekiel warning message, therefore, can be also placed to occur, or the events it heralds, at the end of the age. Now, I'm going to leave to Dr. Rick Sherrod to tell you just who the house of Israel is. But the message of Ezekiel is for now. And what we need to do as the churches of God is to decide how we deal with it. Mr. Armstrong, while he was alive, proclaimed that warning through the book The United States and Britain in Prophecy and other books. Some of our brethren churches continue to proclaim that message through their own publications. The United Church of God, I believe, will eventually follow that. But we as individuals also need to understand or come to a realisation that we have a part to play in supporting that warning message going out to the house of Israel. And that is something that by the end of this weekend, I would hope we would all be inspired to follow up and to become reinvigorated with zeal towards the work, the kind of zeal that was evident when Mr. Armstrong was alive, proclaiming that message.
Well, let's take our hymnals once more and let's really sing out. And number 40. Give yourselves a chance to stretch again. I know a lot of you are not used to this on a Saturday morning, getting up so early. You've missed your morning sleep in, so wake up. Number 40, which is, "Oh, give thanks and praise the Eternal." Everybody sing this time.
Oh, give thanks and praise the Eternal, dwell upon His sacred name. Let His deeds be known among nations, sing to Him, sing songs of praise. Tell of all His marvelous wonders, glory in His most holy name. Let the hearts of those rejoice, who seek God and fear His name. Worship Him forever and ever, never forget His wonderful works. Oh, remember all of His judgments, all His deeds and wonders great. Oh, remember, children of Israel, He made you His chosen ones. He is our God now forever, the Eternal, great is His name. Over all He reigns supreme, all His judgments fill the earth. Worship Him, for was in Jacob, glory for Him, sing praise to His name. The Eternal's word is forever, He confirmed His covenant. And generations to His people Israel. Oh, who came to their possession.
That's it. Only three. We'll stop at three. Okay, please be seated. We're just trying to get this. I think the problem's just there, actually. See that? If you can tighten that up. It's just a bit loose in the top here. See that? So when you put your weight there. Okay. Must be able to tell you the way doing this. Is there a nut or something there? We've got some chewing gum. A wedge, here we go. Try a wedge. Slide it down that way. So. That's okay, that's it.
Got it.
We'll make it neater later. That was the cry. Messed it up again there. Is that okay now? Yep, there you go. Okay, a couple of local announcements. Please, I apologise to our guests. You might have to just hear some announcements that are not necessarily applicable to you. First of all, there will be a Penrith Bible study this coming Monday night at David and Lynn Sandland's place at 7:30. So if anybody wants to go out there for that. Next Sabbath, there'll be services in Newcastle at 10:30 a.m. at Bonnells Bay. Where's Kevin? Is that right? Bonnells Bay, the little school down the bottom there, at 10:30. Not school, I mean hall. Sydney will be at 2 o'clock. That's at the Strathfield Community Centre on Bates Street, up the road here, and Wollongong at 2 o'clock as well. I have a prayer request for you. Anna Ganea, who's not here right this minute, should be here this afternoon. She requests prayers for her cousin's wife. Now, these are the only relatives that Anna has in Australia, and the lady, whose name is Marta, M-A-T-A, Puchalski, P-U-C-H-A-L-S-K-I, Marta Puchalski, she was driving in a 60-kilometre zone, stopped at a light, and was hit by a drunk driver doing 160 kilometres an hour, a young guy with a brand new car. His parents had bought him, and he's never had a job in his life, which shows a lot of problem. So at this point, it appears that she is, the most likely prognosis is severe radical brain damage with paralysis on one side and at this point a collapsed lung. Now certainly she needs your prayers, the prayers of the righteous avail very much, and Anna has requested our prayers on behalf of her cousin's wife. So if we could all remember Marta Puchalski. For anybody who hasn't yet turned their Feast of Tabernacles forms in to inform us where they are for United people, any guests here who'd like to come to United Feast sites, you're more than welcome. And if anybody has not turned in a form yet, could you please get them to Brian Williams today? And hope Brian's got the others today, because I need to get those finalised. He hasn't got them. he gave me a look like, oh no. So if you can get those in today, I guess there might be some others around. I think I used to have some in my briefcase. I might have got rid of them today. I have a request also from the Worldwide Church of God. Rang me up this week and said if anybody would like to join them for a touch football tournament. Peter McLean rang me yesterday afternoon. And so if anybody is interested in forming a team or even with people of anywhere to join in a touch football tournament, maybe you could see Omar. That's a good... Yeah, just chose your name. He looks almost the most athletic one amongst us. I said to Peter, I said, don't look at me, sport. I can't even walk up those stairs at the moment. Okay, there'll be a men's team, a women's team, mixed team, or whatever they can wrap together. Not like it used to be in the old days where we had a stack of teams, and I remember Kel and I, the first time we met each other, was fighting each other with little kids, and we beat him one year, which was good. Okay, the afternoon, the meeting will start at 2 o'clock here, back here at 2 o'clock. There are restaurants in the complex. I think there is a cheaper sort of snack bar. Someone nod if I'm half intelligent here. Right, there is a cheaper sort of snack bar, and there's also a better type place. I guess there's always a McDonald's not far away, or we can meet in the car park and eat sandwiches, whatever you want to do. And tomorrow there'll also be meetings at 11 and 2. The subject this afternoon is the Commonwealth of Nations predicted in the Bible. That's what's got written here anyway. Tomorrow morning is at 11 o'clock. The session begins, the foundations of the Anglo-American rise to political and economic greatness. Maybe we should do a follow-up, the rise and the fall. And the afternoon we have the American, British peoples and Europe and prophecy, which is probably going to be more of the latter part. So that'll be tomorrow afternoon. All the sessions roughly go for about 2 hours. And there probably will be some other people attending with us tomorrow who will be joining with that. Let's see. Also, Craig has given me this announcement that the history research would like to thank the following persons and organisations for their assistance or cooperation with Dr. Sherrod's trip and lecture series. Firstly, Mr. Kevin Watson of Melbourne, whose zeal for the truth led him to sponsor the trip. Also, the Sydney Organising Committee and the committees in each venue that Rick will be visiting. The United Church of God, the Global Church of God, the Worldwide Church of God in Brisbane South, British Israel World Federation, Christian Assemblies International, Christian Education Services, Servants News Magazine, the Journal magazine, the Independent Church of God, Perspectives magazine, Alert newsletter, Sabbath History newsletter, the Shofar newsletter, and many private individuals who have made contributions to these lectures. So I think that's all the announcements we have at this point. Now I have much pleasure in introducing Rick Sherrod, who used to be a chair of the History Department of Ambassador University, and before that, part of the History Department of Ambassador College, before it turned into a university, before it disappeared. And he has a doctorate with a major in history. And so for the rest of the service today, for the sermon, we have Rick Sherrod.
I don't know whether to say howdy or g'day. Let's that up a little bit. Thank you, Mr. Dean, and it's nice to be in Australia. It's my first opportunity to be down under, and really has been a good trip so far. Let me just echo, I know that Mr. Dean mentioned a number of people, but let me maybe add a thing or two to that. In August of 1997, I woke up one morning and on my email, there was a message from Craig White. And I thought it was a joke at first. I mean, I couldn't imagine anyone would want to bring me to Australia. And read it carefully and responded. And then I guess that's been, what, 10 months ago now? Craig, where are you? Oh, there you are. Okay. You're right in between me and the video camera. There you are. Okay. But it's been a delight getting a chance to correspond with Craig. And I now that I'm here, and I've had a chance to kind of look firsthand at all the energy that's gone into the planning and organization of this trip, I'm terribly impressed and immensely grateful. Craig, for those of you who know him, is a tremendously well-organized individual and able to bring together a lot of different threads. The venues are going to take me pretty much all up and down the eastern coast and down toward the south, at least to Melbourne, in Australia. And I want to take a moment to just thank you personally for all you've done to make this at least get to this stage. We'll see whether or not it works after I finish speaking, I suppose. Also, Peter and Vivian Ellis, we really have enjoyed their company. They are hosts extraordinaire. Really have with a couple that's given to hospitality, and we certainly have enjoyed the opportunity to get to know them. And they have put us up during our time here in Sydney. In terms of getting a little bit around, I think Mr. Dean mentioned earlier today, you know, people come in from the outside and maybe we get to see a little bit more of Sydney or see places in Sydney and various other parts of the country that you haven't gone for a long, long time. Murray Allott, who we heard from the sermonette, and Kevin Shaw, they have been dutiful tour guides taking us at all points throughout Sydney. And I guess yesterday we went to the Blue Mountains. And they were kind enough to take us back by through Memory Lane. We went back down to the area in that region that you used to have the feast, I guess, for the most part. And I found that, as a historian, an absolutely delightful experience. To me, I could almost hear I've never been there, but it was like walking through a place where you could almost hear the echoes of church members and children playing back in the playground, an absolutely beautiful sight. We've seen a lot change since those days. And I think God knows what he's doing. I still hadn't figured out myself exactly what it is in terms of the centrifugal force that's broken us apart. I would say this. I am encouraged here in Sydney, as I have been in the other venues that I've spoken at, probably about 30 now, I guess, in all in the United States. There tends to be an almost ecumenical makeup to the group that comes out to hear these presentations and lectures. And I think that's frankly quite good. I know corporate boundaries and institutional ties may separate and perhaps even divide us. But on the other hand, we're tied together by things that are commonly shared and held beliefs. And I think it is very good that we're able. I was heartened by even Mr. Dean's mention of several groups and the announcement relevant to another one of my old friends, Peter McLean. And I can't imagine. He must be held together by chewing gum and bailing wire, as we say down in Texas at this point. I haven't aged, but I know Peter certainly has. I remember playing some sport with him at some educational program at Orr, and I guess at some point we're going to cross paths. I think someone was telling me, was it you, Vivian? Someone the other day told me that Peter is looking for me. I'm not sure why. But it'll be nice again to say hello to friends that I made within the boundaries of the Church of God over the years. Thanks, too, to the National Organizing Committee for helping to make the trip happen. Many, many different private individuals. I know Kevin Watson really, I guess, bore the lion's share of the cost of getting me down here. And United Church of God in particular for its cooperation with the project, as well as the various other churches of God that we've heard mentioned here today. Maybe a comment or two on just being in Australia. For me, this is I don't know if it'll be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It may or may not be, but it's certainly an exciting opportunity for me. My formal academic training and studies have concentrated really on the development, the rise, and then I guess I'm in part a witness and a participant in the fall of not only the Commonwealth nations, but also the nation from which I hail and have citizenship, the United States, the Anglo-American condominium. But it's been fun to actually go and see. I know Vivian, the first day that we were here, took us way out around Botany Bay. And for those who know anything about Australian history, it just, like the feast site for church members, Botany Bay resonates with this rich history. And, you know, Cook and then after him, Philip and La Perouse, I believe it is. That to me, as you'll see, the French have a very important role to play in the story that I'm going to spin for you today, what I will tell you and what will unfold. In another sense, I suppose it's renewed my personal conviction going out and about through Greater Sydney and then into the mountain range yesterday that God certainly, whether or not you may believe that we are Israelitish in terms of our ethnical background, makeup and stock, we're a group of people, the Anglo-American people. We are a group that God has certainly blessed and prospered in an extraordinary way, a very special way. With that in mind, let me lay, in a sense, some cards face up on the table, and then I'll tell you what I'm going to talk about here. This is it morning still? I'm kind of caught in mid. My body is here, but parts of me are between here and the Los Angeles over the Pacific Ocean. International travel, you kind of catch up with yourself over a span of days. Maybe I can put it this way: I'm one voice in a chorus on this particular subject. I have a particular maybe insight to offer on an aspect or two of what really is a vast subject. As I've studied this in a concentrated way over the past decade and a little bit more than that, I guess now, I've come to appreciate that there are many different people who have things to offer to the discussion on who is Israel in modern times, why should that even be important to us. There are those, and I noticed his books in the back. Craig has managed to gather a wide-ranging body of literature, which is out for display and distribution. And many of you, no doubt, are already well acquainted with the works of people like Stephen Collins, The Lost Tribes of Israel Found, the book that he has put out. That particular area that Steve explored is not especially my forte. The elements in antiquity are kind of filling the gap of where the evidence is a bit more thin. Mine is more in terms of the study of modern British history. And by, you know, you talk to someone that would be, I don't know, under 25 years old, when you say modern, modern history is more or less dated from 1963 when the Beatles performed on the Ed Sullivan Show. Okay, I'm a historian, and when I say modern, I'm talking mid-15th century A.D., okay, a little longer sweep than that. My focus, as you will see as we go through the sermon and then especially the series of slide presentations that I'll have to share with you, it's a bit more focused on how prophecies have been fulfilled in more recent times. I would also like to point out that this understanding, which is certainly not unique to those of us in the Church of God, this understanding is precisely that. In my scheme of things and in the way that I present it, yes, indeed it's important. However, at the same time, I want to be quick to add, it is a doctrine of understanding. And that is palpably and significantly different than doctrine unto salvation. Let me just demonstrate what I mean by that. If you look at the broad sweep of the Church of God, its history over 2,000 years, it's interesting that probably most people that God has called and worked with over two millennia did not have the understanding that for some reason, and we'll get to that, in fact, Murray touched on that quite significantly in the sermonette. Most people who will be a part of the greater family of God, our brothers and sisters spiritually, they will not have had this understanding, nor, frankly, given the mission and role of the Church of God in their respective times, that they necessarily even need it. If they had known it, they might not have seen the relevance. Now, to me, this understanding is tied intimately, it's intertwined and bound with the issue of mission of the Church of God. The way Mr. Allett presented it to us earlier this morning has to do with, does the Church of God have a responsibility and a role to let the Israelitish people know that God certainly will hold us accountable, that He will call us into account? Now, the blessings that we're going to look at here in a moment, I'll launch into the body of the sermon, which has to do with the promises that were given to the patriarch Abraham. And there was a point at which that promise, both the physical and spiritual aspects of the promises, plural, those became unconditional. And regardless of what might happen or unfold amongst the descendants of Abraham, at a certain point, at a certain juncture, the promise of Messiah, of Jesus Christ, which is the more important of the two relevant to salvation, that promise ultimately was going to be fulfilled, and it would be fulfilled through the line of Judah. Now, the physical, material, national dimensions of the promise, those promises which, as we read in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, fall upon the house or the descendants of the son of Jacob, namely Joseph, all right, those blessings have come regardless. They've come irrespective of what the people of Israel have done. And we'll look in a little while at some verses which fairly clearly demonstrate that. We, as what I would argue is essentially Israelitish stock, or people descended from ancient Israel, we're the beneficiaries. You and I are the ones in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, in South Africa, in the United States of America, the British Isles. We have benefited from something that someone did a long, long time ago, 17th century, 18th century B.C., depending on how you prefer to date the patriarch Abraham. And we find ourselves, in the late 20th century, heirs to remarkable physical national promises. Is God going to allow us to retain that forever if we continue to behave the way we do? Now, I stand here as a national, a citizen of the United States of America, and I'll tell you without hedging a bit, you know, of the offspring of Israel, our nation is leading the pack in terms of all kinds of aberrant behaviors. Okay? Now, I've also noticed in my travels through the British Isles and other parts of the Commonwealth that, you know, everyone else is not all that far behind. Is God going to allow us to continue living that way forever? Will He? He didn't with ancient Israel. Around the late 8th century B.C., a very, rough-hewn group of people, and Mr. White is what I consider to be an expert on Assyriology and the tie that you can make between the Assyrians and what you would call the more modern-day German peoples. A group of Assyrians came spilling over the borders into the Northern Kingdom, and in just a matter of a few decades, those folks were whisked away into captivity. They disappeared over the Mesopotamian horizon, and for the most part, as far as the historical record is concerned, they've never been heard from or seen again. Now, we, because God has opened our mind to certain aspects of understanding, I think we can find the connective tissue and put it together, and we have a pretty good idea of where to find those people. Same thing happened with the kingdom of Judah a few generations down the line. There's even a prophecy in the book of Jeremiah, which you probably are acquainted with, where the Jews, like the Israelites before them, viewed themselves, the northern kingdom, I mean, they viewed, both kingdoms viewed themselves as God's people. And God certainly wouldn't let anything bad happen to His people, would He? The phrase, is expressed in the book of Jeremiah, the temple of God, the temple of God. Meaning Solomon's temple is here. It's a housing, as it were, for God to be among His people. Surely God wouldn't let anything bad happen to those people, would He? Did He? if we are the descendants of those people, or for that matter, even if we're not, is a God who is the God of all people, of all blood, in a sense, all race, creed, color, in the sense of humanity. Is that God going to let things go on forever without calling people into account? And I think the answer is emphatically no. He won't. Now, will that God just arbitrarily start sending lightning bolts down like someone from Mount Olympus, Zeus? Okay, if you keep up with American movies, which is, I've noticed that America has established certain outposts of imperial presence here, like McDonald's and Coca-Cola, to be, I guess, the two most prominent. I mean, even Mr. Dean, I think, mentioned McDonald's. Okay, I'm not sure. Maybe Australia exported it to the States, but I think we invented it. And I don't know whether that's to our credit or our blame. We'll see. Now, before, again, I launch into the main balance of the sermon, let me speak to another issue, because this is an issue which, as I've, over the past 12 years or so, focused my energies on studying the subject. One of the things that's always fascinated me is the history of the idea. Mr. White set up a very delightful experience for me. I think it was the second day I was here, which I believe was Thursday. If you're this side of the international dateline, it was Thursday. I had a chance to do a little radio interview with Gordon Moyes, I think is his name. And the exchange there led inevitably to the issue of, isn't this notion of British Israelism a racist concept? And that's inevitable. When you get into this terrain, you're going to have to come face to face with it. And my own background, I'm a historian professionally and by training, and I like to know where ideas originate and from whence they've come. And for me, I have in the past decade and a few years spent a lot of time sifting and sorting through what you would call the old British Israel literature. Now, it is a sad matter of fact that many authors, I won't say most, but I'm trying to be kind, much of that literature is sadly tarnished and tainted by an outlook which, and I'm not going to try to excuse it, is just simply flat outright racist. I'm going to speak to that here in a moment about where Israel fits in the broad sweep and scheme of things. Murray, in his sermonette time, talked about calling or finding out, and you know, the booklet being withdrawn, Mr. Armstrong's booklet on the subject, it being elitist, I think, cultist, were the two terms I think he used, perhaps a little softer language for just out-and-out racism. Okay, many people have used it in that way. And I'm here to tell you at the front end of what I have to say to you, brethren, that is wrong. Shouldn't be among the people of God. And those among our former fellowship have taken that club out and beaten us over the head with it. I'm not saying they've not justifiably done so. But many people who have embraced this notion or accepted this notion as one way to look at the world and especially make sense out of the 19th and 20th centuries, they have done it with a racist edge. And that's not what the Bible tells us. What race is the greatest race? What race is the most superior race? Let me go to a story which I'm fond of because I find it a little bit amusing myself. Tell you a little bit about a 16th century Roman emperor, Charles V. Now, he's not a biblical figure, but he gets the point across. You may remember some of our literature. Keith Stump did a booklet a number of years ago called History of Europe and the Church. Many of you probably have that. Okay, and in it, it will show you various resurrections of the old Roman Empire. And Charles V is there, reared back. He's not reared back. The horse he's on, I guess, is reared back. And he's sitting there in all his imperial splendor and glory. And Charles, at one point in time, as he surveyed the landscape of Europe, the political hierarchy of nations in the early 1500s, he made this statement. He said, "I speak Latin to God." Charles was a good practicing Roman Catholic. Martin Luther had just come on the scene. Okay, French to diplomats, lingua franca, a commonly shared language among people that are in political circles. And you know, you may not be able to speak English, you may not be able to speak German, but both of you can speak French, so you can communicate that way. "I speak Spanish to the ladies," a good romantic language. has a ring to it, pretty ring. I speak Italian to musicians. I remember we're in the day and age when the European Renaissance was still somewhat in bloom, and music flourished in Italy. One of my children who's with me here is interested in going to Italy because a lot of the old ambassador group, they're headed to, I guess, not Rome, but somewhere there in Italy for the feast. And they want to see some of these Renaissance sites. He went on to conclude by saying, I speak German to my servants. Because you see, in the 1500s, the Germans were a group of fragmented people with principalities and city-states and little kingdoms and municipalities all over the place, hadn't drawn together in a nationalist way, and they wouldn't, frankly, until around Otto von Bismarck in the late 1800s. And I speak English to my horses. Now, it's taken a while since the days of Charles V for the English, Anglo-Saxon, we'll call them, people, to revise the balance of power. We, in a sense, are victims of the age in which we live. I think if we don't know a little bit of history, and history is a much maligned and oftentimes forgotten discipline in our universities and primary and secondary schools, we've forgotten from whence we've come as a people, at least in the areas of the Anglo-American world where I've traveled. Most young people and many old people don't remember that the rise of Great Britain and in its wake of the United States of America and all the Commonwealth nations like Australia and various other ones that we could name is a recent phenomenon and development in history. The booklet that we saw held before us in the sermonette, that booklet makes a point. Herbert W. Armstrong was closer in terms of his lifespan. When was he born? In the 1890s, if I remember correctly. All right. He knew people who could remember a time when the rise of Britain and then later America was somewhat of a novelty on the stage of world history. Why did it happen when it did? And all that, again, I would submit to you, has to do with the unfolding and the bequeathing and the giving or the dispensing by God of certain promises that had become unconditional on a certain timetable, in a certain sequence, in a certain order, to fulfill promises to a patriarch, to a man whose name was Abraham, originally Abram, and we're going to talk a bit about him in the sermon here this morning. Two aspects of the sermon then today. For those of us who've grown up in the Spokesman Club tradition, this is the SPS, right? This is what I'm going to try to talk to you about today. One is the Abrahamic promises, and note that I word that in the plural form. There are two aspects of those promises. And then we'll conclude by making some observations about how we ought to go about interpreting Scripture. Much of the difference of opinion that arose in the early 1990s within our previous fellowship, which gave rise to various other, you fill in the descriptive adjective, churches of God, okay? Much of that sprang out of differences of opinion over how Scripture ought to be interpreted. And we'll conclude the sermon time today by talking a bit about that. If you'll turn initially, and this may seem like an odd place to start, but again, I want you to understand the perspective that I have on this. And there are landmines, and I think it is very important that we as Christians not offend where offense is not necessary. Now, if people want to superimpose upon us things that we don't necessarily believe or embrace, that's their business. And odds are, you know, we'll be tarred and feathered with a lot of things based on our faithfulness to true, authentic, genuine teachings of Christ and of God as inspired in the Scriptures. Deuteronomy 7 and verse 7, if you'll look, why did God decide to work with Israel? Were the Israelites just plain downright better than every other ancient world people? No, I don't think we can make that claim. Again, going back to the concepts that I introduced with those stories from Charles V, if indeed that was the case, why in the world did, if we are somehow racially or ethnically superior, why did the English-speaking people wait until around 1800 to cast off their disguise of inferiority? Why was it that it happened when it did? Now, with that thought in mind, Deuteronomy 7 and verse 7. Moses, talking to a group of stiff-necked Israelites who'd given him fits for 40 years. Okay? As they were about to cross the Jordan River, he said, "Now I want you to remember this. God did not set his love up on you, neither did he choose you because," and then note the phrase, "because you were more in number than any other people." There were a lot greater peoples in the ancient. If God had been looking for Saul, okay, someone that was taller, bigger, better, had the look of the one that ought to be in charge, he wouldn't have picked the Israelites. Maybe the Hittites. They were pretty good soldiers, as the record of antiquity bears out. Perhaps the Egyptians. Babylonians, it would take them a little while to come on stream in terms of their heyday, I suppose. They had several rises and falls, as it were. But as you survey the landscape, why Israel? You weren't more in number than any people. You were, in fact, the fewest of all people. Now, maybe that's a difficult concept to grasp on the surface, but for us who are called by God into His church in the last days, maybe it's not so much of a stretch of imagination. Now, in my American audiences, I will at this point typically say, "Bill Gates, would you please stand up?" Now, is Bill Gates, are we aware in Australia who Bill Gates is? One of the, okay. Well, where is he? Why is Bill Gates not here? Or Ted Turner, another big name in the United States. Some of you know who Ted Turner is. Married to Jane Fonda. You may know who Jane Fonda is, a famous American actress. I'm here, you're here. And some of you may do quite well professionally or financially, but the majority of us, you know, we've had to kind of make ends meet as best we could through most of our life. Deuteronomy 7, verse 7 is an Old Testament corollary, I would submit to you, of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26, 7, and 8. Who has God called in this New Testament age? He's called the weak. He's called the foolish. He's not called the mighty. He's not called the jet-setters, the rich and the famous, by and large. Maybe a handful here and there to boost the income when the church is needed to accomplish certain of God's ends. But most of us don't fly in those circles. I certainly don't. We're pretty much plain old, common, ordinary, vanilla folks. And that's the way God likes to work. And I suspect I know why. Because at some point in time, He is going to turn to those in their order. We were talking, I guess, I forget who it was today, about the last great day and its relevance and meaning. He'll be able to turn after He's made a silk purse out of those of us who are sow's ears, and then He yanks up the multiple millions of people when the last great day, what it forecasts and pictures, when that is realized. And He'll turn to us and say, "Remember this guy? He was, you know, he lived in this part of your town. And guess what? He's a part of my family now. And if he can make it, if she can make it, odds are pretty good you can make it as well." I think that's how God goes about selecting and choosing. Now, not always, and Abraham may depart, I suppose, to some degree from this model that I've sketched. Let's go to Genesis chapter 12. That was the introduction. Now let's get down to the heart of the matter. Genesis, the 12th chapter. Abram was a remarkable individual. For many reasons, I think we can say that. And I'm here in Sydney today to make a point that his story is not just his story. It is your story and it is my story, if we choose to make it so. The parallels are startling. Let's go through the first few verses of Genesis 12, and I think it will become apparent. Probably many of you have seen these threads before. "Now the Eternal," verse 1, "had said unto Abram, 'Get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house. I want you to go into a land that I'm going to show you.'" You and I have done that. Now, for anyone who has come into the church of God, there are two ways, by the way, to get into the church of God. You can grow up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And there's some in this audience who have done that. You never had a fighting chance. Mom and dad attended the church, brought you along, drug you along perhaps. You sat there in your chair, you slept there from a babe in arms. You grew up, and this is just the way of life that you've been immersed in. Okay. Now, the end is the same. You're going to wind up getting to where God wants you, into His kingdom, even though you may have taken a different route than mom and dad have taken. The other route is the one that I happen to have taken. It was called the Road to Damascus. Now, I like Damascus. I've been to Damascus a couple of times in my life. It is a really neat place. For those of you who like to shop, you're going to find some of the best shopping on earth in Damascus. It's exciting. The atmosphere is electric. Paul was headed to Damascus to take care of certain business, and I think most of us in this audience know the story. And wouldn't you know it, as he walked down that road, God slapped him down and said, "You need to understand some things. We're going to take you and put you on a different trajectory and on a different route." And it seems to have worked because he wound up writing 14 books of the Bible. He's a major figure, and much of our theology is drawn from those things that he laid out for us. Now, for those of us who have gone down that particular road and been slapped silly by God in progress, we've gone through similar experiences as Abraham experienced. Again, look at what God says to him. Leave your country. Now, we may not physically have gotten up and moved. In my case, I did. I left the warm, comfortable confines of Arlington, Texas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, got on an airplane, and flew out to the land of fruits and nuts, Pasadena, California, and enrolled in this little obscure college that some cult sponsored, at least according to the view of most of my family. Some of you are laughing and chuckling, and you've probably been there and done that kind of thing, if not go to college. You know, the experience is pretty much a similar experience. I want you to leave your kindred, leave your father's house, and I'm here to tell you that I'm still doing damage control from the way in which I made my departure. Okay, I grew up in a traditional Christian denomination in the Bible Belt of the United States of America, and I had the deftness of a jackhammer in terms of the way that I tried to bring every family member and friend within a 100-mile radius along with me, kicking and screaming into the Church of God. I was so successful that today I remain the only one among all my family and friends who's ever embraced this way of life. Again, as I say, still doing damage control. Gave up a clear-cut career track, and I know some of you have experienced that as well. I knew precisely, as I was headed down the road to Damascus, what I wanted to do. I was within 9 months of getting there. And then, you know, the Sabbath doesn't go well with coaching, track and field. At least in North America, it doesn't. I wound up pretty much leaving that behind. Now, God has compensated in other respects. I think I'm a lot broader person. I probably would never have gone the directions that I did in terms of education and travel experience and so on. And for that, His way certainly has been a better way. Into a land that I will show you. If you look over in Hebrews 11, verses 8 and 9, or just maybe make a note and check me out later. Abraham didn't know where he was going. He hadn't vacationed down in Canaan. This wasn't a hot spot, you know, for tourists, like up in the Blue Mountains. Okay, there wasn't a cottage that he trekked off to. Fact of the matter was, Hebrew tradition, if we can believe that, and I think there's good reason to do so, he came from a family of substance. Terah, his father, at least according to the traditions that you'll find in various Jewish writings, probably made real good money, was in the upper echelon of a very comfortable society, and the archaeological evidence in those areas where Ur of the Chaldees probably was indicates that there was a society that had a fairly high standard of living, at least for the upper crust. Good old Terah evidently made his money in manufacturing and trade of idols. And God looked down at Abram and he said, "I don't want you to be a part of that any longer. I want you to live in a different style, fashion, and way, and I want you to get completely out of the area." And Abram, probably over a span of years, ultimately made the move, which eventually landed him down in the land of Canaan. Now, another interesting aspect about the way this promise is framed, well, those of you who are lawyers in the audience would understand quid pro quo. It's a Latin phrase, which means you give me something and I will give you something back in exchange. And the promise, as it is stated to Abram and then later Abraham, we find it 7 times in the book of Genesis, relevant to Abraham, and then other times as it's passed on to various ones of his descendants. Up until we get to the final repetition of that 7 statements that we see in the book of Genesis, it pretty much remains in this form. You do this, Abraham, then I will do these other things for you. Now, we've seen what, in verse 1, God required of Abraham, or Abram at this stage. What is he going to get back in exchange? Verse 2, let's read it. Note carefully the nature of the things that are promised. I will make of you a great nation. That's inherently physical and national, regardless of what we may have heard in the early 1990s, spiritualizing that element away. Goes on to say, I will bless you, and I'm going to make your name great, glory, as you would receive in this world, in this life. And you shall be a blessing. Verse 3, I will bless them that bless you, and I will curse them that curse you. Now, I'm in the midst of a part of the old English Commonwealth. I can remember about a decade ago, Bob Fay, who I think was down in Australia for a period of time, if I remember right, his part of his resume includes a stint in Australia. And we were talking about British Commonwealth-type things. And one of the things that Bob pointed out, which I've forever associated with this verse from that point in time, is he said, you know, when the empire began to break down, 1948, India decided they wanted to become an independent nation. And as they say, India was the linchpin of the old British Empire. Once you pull that brick out of place, within 15 to 20 years, most of what you would call the non-white parts of the empire had pretty much come unraveled, particularly in the African nations. And Bob said, you know, it's interesting that those nations that sent the British packing with a kind of an edge of we wish you ill and we didn't like the fact that you were here and we're glad you're gone. Those nations have struggled. Those nations which have tried to be more cooperative. Kenya was the example that he used. Now, Kenya's not been, let's say, I'm not planning on immigrating there, okay? But on the other hand, in the sweep of the nations of Africa, Kenya's had a better go of it. And Bob suggested that that may well be one of these reverberating echoes down through the quarters of time of the promise to Abraham. And even still today, there are reasonably positive relations which exist between Britain and the nation state of Kenya. Now, as we get to the end of verse 3, and again, I'll speak very clearly, and I mean this to be powerful, and it's important. The last phrase suddenly shifts to entirely new terrain. There are two aspects to this promise, the promises of Abraham are twofold. One deals with physical, national blessings and greatness. The other deals with spiritual things. And in you shall all families, abolishing distinctions of one national group or one ethnic group from the next to the next to the next. And if you carry it over into the book of Romans or the book of Galatians where Paul addresses these issues, it abolishes distinctions of gender, socioeconomic status. We're all pretty much the same. As Solomon said in the book of Ecclesiastes, we all wind up in the same place anyway. Okay? We may make a run for greater glory or lesser glory in our 70 or so years. But when it all boils down to it, this is really the most important of the two aspects. All families of the earth are going to be blessed. The promise of Messiah, yes, relevant to the throne of David, but more important to the coming of Jesus Christ and the Christ sacrifice. Now, I'm not here to talk to you about that today. Going back to the sermonette, there's going to come a point in time, and we've not seen it yet, unless Herbert Armstrong fulfilled this, where a witness, a grabbing of the lapels, and a shaking, if you will, till the teeth veritably rattle, to the Anglo-Saxon nations of the world is given. So that they're not going to scratch their heads and say, boy, I wonder why things have turned so bad for us all of a sudden. We saw the prophecy of the thirds that was read in the sermonette out of the book of Ezekiel. There's some bad things that are going to come on this world. And if we are Israel, and indeed, as was suggested, Israel, as the end of the age approaches, is going to go through some of these punishments. Our peoples have some very negative things to look forward to. Okay, we better hope there's a place of safety. Because if we're in the midst of all of this, it's going to take some drastic miracles to keep us out of the maelstrom. Now, let's move forward and just touch for a moment or two on some of these other statements of the promise. You don't get any further. Verse 3 completes really the first example of the promise to Abraham. You get 1, 2, 3. The fourth verse away from that, suddenly God is reminding Abram of these promises. Why is that? I think I know the answer. I think I know an answer. If God had worked with me in a little different fashion, if when I was called in 1971, 28 or so years ago, in the summer actually it was, of 1971, and He had, through those people that worked with me and taught me and brought me along into the doctrines and teachings and truths of the Church of God, if God had rolled out a scroll and said, "Now, Rick, this is your life. You're 21 years of age, and you're going to come into the church, and things are going to go well for 6-9 months, and guess what's going to happen after that?" And some of you are smiling. You've been there and done this, haven't you? It's going to go all haywire. And you're not going to like it for a year or two or three, and then things will come back into balance, and there'll be a period of time where they'll go fairly well. Oh, man, and you're really not going to like the mid-80s. That's going to be a bad time. And if you think that's bad, just wait till you get to the late 90s. You know what I would have done if God had done that? I would have said, "See ya. Thank you very much for making the contact. I really appreciate getting, you know, to meet you and all, but I have my life going the way I wanted it to go when you knocked me down on the road to Damascus. And if it's all the same to you, I'll just keep right on going. I've got some shopping to do in the souk." But God doesn't work that way, does He? Probably, for those of us who are baptized, somewhere some minister sat down with us and rolled out Luke 14, verse 26, and we said, "Now, what is it going to cost to join up here? Show me the fine print. How much does it cost to sign up with this outfit?" "Oh, not very much. Just everything you have. Including your own life also," to paraphrase the words of Christ as recorded by Luke. Now, the way God deals with that is that He punctuates our lives by reminders of the promises that He has for us. He did it with Abram, who later becomes Abraham, and He's done it in my life. And I don't think I'm the only one in this group of folks here today that probably has gone through that kind of experience. Otherwise, if we got into too much rough water without any encouragement or reminder along the way, we'd be bailing off the ship. Like one of Philip's crew members saying, "Australia is a long way from England. I think I'm just going to jump overboard because there's not much chance of getting back to God's country." Verse 7, God appeared to Abram and He said, "Unto you and your seed, I'm going to give this land." Don't forget that. There's a benefit. That's my part of this quid pro quo arrangement. Now, chapter 13, we find the third example. And I really do like this example. It's a wonderful example because you have a man, Abram, who departs from the traditional human way of doing things. There are so few instances in human history, for that matter, in my own personal life, where I see people stepping outside their own personal self-interests and giving someone else the bigger piece of the pie. Now, some of you may know Dave Gothels. Dave was a colleague of mine, or you may have heard of him over the years. He worked in summer camp, and the deans, I'm sure, have met him over the years. And Dave grew up in a big family. I was an only child, and I did not learn a lot because of that. There are advantages and disadvantages to being it. But Dave grew up in a big, big family. And he said there was basically bloodletting. When there was one extra piece of pie left, you know, after dinner. And anyway, Gil Gothels, his father, finally designed a way to keep the kids from killing each other when they fought over it. Okay, draw straws or some such thing as that. You don't find many examples where people are willing to let go of things. Abraham was different. Now, chapter 13 is the story of Lot, the herdsman of Lot and the herdsman of Abraham. They come down to this well-watered plain land, probably in the area today where you find the Dead Sea. That's my hunch, although there are differing ideas about where Sodom and Gomorrah may have been located. And there's an element, there's a pathos in this. Abraham was told to get out of Ur of the Chaldees. He was told to leave his family and his kindred. And any of us in God's church who have had to walk away from family, and I think that does include many in this audience, we identify with it. Let me go back, and there's a loose end I should close. The location, by the way, which Abraham was told to leave was where? Babylonia. God told him to get out of Babylon. Boy, that sounds familiar. Where have I heard that before? Oh, yeah. Revelation 18, verse 4. As it's spoken to us. He acted out at the physical level in a certain respect, in a certain way. The spiritual journey or experience which you and I have had to make to get where we are today, filling these seats in the midst of the brethren of the Church of God. Now, in doing that, oftentimes we walked away from family members, and that was painful, and it hurt. And as best we might have tried to explain the logic of the revealed truth that God had given us, you know, our parents, our cousins, our nephews, our nieces just couldn't get it. Well, it takes a miracle from God revealing that understanding. And the revelation aspect I'll come back to in terms of this issue of the United States and Britain and their identities today, and their tie to ancient Israel. In the midst of all of that, there was one bright light for Abram. His adopted son, a nephew of his, named Lot. Only human element of that family that came along with him, other than his wife Sarah. And wouldn't you know it, they'd barely gotten settled in, and then this friction develops. And I would submit to you there's much more emotion to this story than perhaps might initially meet the eye. He had to let go of that relationship. And the way in which he does it is remarkable. Now, God had the Bible inspired. Presumably Moses wrote these texts. And in verse 14, it is framed in a certain way which I think telegraphs across millennia of time important lessons to you and me. Verse 14, "And the Eternal said unto Abram," note this phrase, "after that Lot was separated from him." It's almost as though Lot had just disappeared over the horizon. And God chooses that to be the moment to say, "Attaboy, Abraham. That's what I'm looking for. You let him choose." On point of fact, it turned out not to be much of a good choice in the long run. Choosing through our own human wisdom oftentimes results in that. He then tells Abraham to lift up now your eyes. I want you to look from the place where you are. I want you to look north, south, east, and west. That's going to be yours. Reminder of the promise. And it came at a moment where Abraham had chosen to forsake his own best self-interest. Fourth example of the promise as it appears in the book of Genesis is in chapter 15, verses 4 through 21. And if you'll look, we won't read it for sake of time, but if you'll look at verses 18 through 21, it talks about territory, physical, national kinds of blessings to be promised. Now, a fifth instance where the promise is recorded respecting Abraham is in chapter 17. It's the longest articulation of this promise. It covers the first 22 verses or so. Verse 5, we read, "It is the time at which Abraham's name is changed from Abram to Abraham, meaning father of a multitude, father of many nations, father of a group of people," because that's what he's about to become. In addition to that, I want to draw something to your attention because this will be an echo that will follow us through the presentations and the slides that we'll look at later today and on through tomorrow for those of you who I have not offended to the point that you won't come back for Sunday's presentations. The parallel or corollary to this, a parallel passage I guess we could say, is Exodus 12 and verse 41. The wording of that passage is interesting because it says the Israelites left Egypt 430 years from, and if you'll note the wording, it says the self same day. What does that mean? There would have been a greater economy of use of language just to say from the same day, or from the day. The self same day. Why the emphasis? Now, Keith Stump, a number of years ago, I mentioned the booklet that he wrote. He wrote an article, probably April of 86, 87, if you kept your old Good News magazines, on the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Who was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? And one of the points that he makes in this is chapter 17 of Genesis is the reconfirming of the covenant to Abraham. It, a little more headlights and trumpets sounding and so on with this particular restatement of the promise. It's interesting to note that if you join this passage in chapter 17 with Exodus 12 and verse 41, which Hebrew tradition maintains you should do, that means that God chose the first day of unleavened bread 430 years prior to the Exodus to reconfirm the covenant. Now, you may already be aware of this trend, but if you aren't Now, by the end of today, you will have seen examples. In the history of Old Testament Israel, there's an interesting correspondence between key national events, developments, that take place among God's people on holy day dates. Does it surprise you to know that in Anglo-American history, the same pattern continues? Now, I'll talk a lot, note that word in particular. A lot of what I'll share with you today and tomorrow is in respect to patterns. No, we probably won't know the name, the address, and social security number, as it were, of the beast. Although I can remember with great clarity in the mid-70s, I was living in the Dallas-Fort Worth area at that time, and a key administrator back in those days of the college flew in a fellow named Franz Joseph Strauss. Some of you remember Franz Joseph. Okay? And at the time, there was much talk among the people of God about who will the beast be? Who's he out there? And, bless the heart of whoever edited the portfolio back then, and I hope it's not someone in this audience. There was a screaming banner headline that all but said, "Beast visits Big Sandy campus." Now, unless God is planning on resurrecting poor old Franz Joseph, we got that one wrong. Because he died a decade or so ago. I don't remember when it was. Does that mean that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater? We'll develop that concept throughout the rest of the day. There is a use for prophecy, as my friend pointed out in the sermon that time. Now, let's move on to chapter 18. We have a sixth statement of this promise. Genesis 18, verses 10 through 18. The context here is we suddenly realize Lot did not make the good choice after all, because God's about to unleash fire and brimstone to come down on the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's not particularly good news. Verse 10, the promise is repeated. The angelic visitor to Abraham and Sarah, "I will certainly return unto you according to the time of life. Sarah, your wife is going to have a son." Now, Abraham and Sarah, like you and me, as members of God's spiritual Israel, we tend sometimes to get a bit impatient and say, "God's never going to solve this problem or that problem or the other problem, and I would have been better off never to have gotten involved in this," etc., etc., ad infinitum, ad nauseum. But sometimes God lets us exhaust human methods before He finally says, "Okay, good, now you know you can't fix this. Now get out of my way and watch what happens." Abraham waited for decades before God eventually gave that son a promise. Now, if you'll drop down to verse 17, there's another interesting passage which feeds nicely into what we heard in the sermonette time. "And the Eternal said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do?" Let me phrase it a little differently. Does God give His people insight into the broad contours and patterns of things that are going to develop and happen? Things not yet realized? I think He does. I think He does. And I think your presence here today, again, as Craig and I have discussed what to talk about and how to go about it, one of the things that we've come back to again and again is the Australians are very interested in things relevant to prophecy. And I'll share, at least from my limited perspective, some insights and thoughts which hopefully can be helpful and encouraging as we go along through the next couple of days here. The piece de resistance, the final, the seventh account. The nature of the promise changes. And the story is a remarkable one. And I want to, I don't particularly want to talk about what I'm about to talk about here, because it bothers me and troubles you, and it may trouble you as well. You and I, Romans 4, verse 16, are the children of Abraham. We're heirs, in a sense, to the kind of faith that made Abraham a different kind of a fellow. We find in his personal story that God did something that was utterly inexplicable. He gave the son of the promise. I don't know how many years passed, 5, 10, 40. The Bible doesn't say for sure. There are various Hebrew traditions. But when Abraham thought, "Well, it's all done. Things have come together. I'm now satisfied that God knows what He's doing. I'm happy with the way things have worked out. I have my son here, Isaac, to carry on and to inherit the promises." Then God says, "Now I want you to take Isaac up to the top of Mount Moriah, tie him up, put him on a stack of wood, slit his throat, and burn him. Go figure. But brethren, we are, in a certain spiritual sense, the children of Abraham. What is your Isaac? Now think about that for a minute. What is it that is the most important thing in your life? I'm not saying that God is going to call upon you to demonstrate your willingness to sacrifice it, but I am saying that you and I better be willing to take Isaac to the mountaintop if at some future point or juncture, that's what God requires of us. Now, your Isaac will probably be different from my Isaac. I hope I've already taken Isaac to the mountaintop. But in point of fact, there are junctures in all of our lives where we may indeed think we've taken Isaac to the mountaintop when actually all we've done is shaken hands with Lot and bid him farewell. Not particularly good news, but we need to be realistic. The saving grace in 1 Corinthians, I believe it's chapter 10, is God won't put upon us anything greater than we are able to bear. So we can rest easy. Now, let's go back to verse 12. This is the point at which God transforms the nature, in a sense, of the covenant. The angel, speaking on God's behalf, says, "Don't lay your hand upon the lad, Isaac, neither do anything unto him." And then notice this phrase, "For now I know. I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son." Implying there was a point before which God knew he could trust Abraham here and there and maybe over here in another place. But what about letting go and relinquishing the most important thing in his life? In verse, if you'll drop down to verse 16, we see that it now becomes an unconditional covenant. "I said, by myself now have I sworn." There are no longer two parties to this agreement. It is unconditional. God is going to fulfill it through the descendants of Abraham, come what may. And I would suggest to you that the reason that we enjoy the kind of high standard of living where we can sit in a nice facility and hall like this, living in a part of the world that is richly enhanced with all kinds of blessings and benefits, it's more rightly explained by what we read here than it is any particular unique abilities, talents, or superior qualities that we as a unique group of people, a racial group of people, might have. Now, let me insert here a vignette. James 2 and verse 23 identifies Abraham as, it says, a friend of God. Abraham was pretty much like you and me in a lot of respects. Now, the Bible is a unique manuscript in the ancient world. If you want to look at the Egyptians or the Hittites or other surviving documents that have come out of these ancient world cultures, they read like press releases from Bill Clinton's White House. They try to present the best possible image without showing any of the warts, any of the scars, any of those things that would present an unseemly appearance. The Bible doesn't do that. Abraham is an interesting case in point. He's called, we read about his calling in Genesis chapter 12. We get to verse 11, and he's lying. Okay, he's shading the truth. Sarah was his sister. And, you know, can you imagine that conversation? Putting his arm around his mate for life, saying, "Honey, now here's what I want you to do. You know these Egyptians, you just can't trust them. They're not godly people at all. And they're liable to do anything, and you're a pretty good looking woman. And they're going to want to kill me to get you and take you to the Pharaoh. So just tell him you're my sister." In fact, what we're looking at here is a time-honored, long-standing male pattern of behavior which dates from the Garden of Eden. Namely, the male's proclivity to be willing to put the woman at risk in order to defend himself. "This woman is the woman you gave me, that's the one. I mean, I wouldn't eat an apple, but she handed it to me. She has all these leverages over me." Now, that didn't stand very securely with God. Both Adam and Eve were punished for that. Now, if that weren't bad enough, by the time we get to chapter 20, he's doing the same thing with Abimelech. Twice. For those of you who are acquainted with high scholarship and theology and all that business, I know that they felt like poor old Moses, who recorded this stuff, the guy was as dumb as a post. He had these two traditions, and they were a little different, so what he did is he separated them by enough scripture where hopefully we wouldn't remember about the two accounts. I don't think that's, regardless of what higher theology may argue, I think Abraham had a problem with shading the truth, and I think that's why God put it in here. But you know, he overcame that. And as I said in Romans 4, he's defined, in essence, as the father of the faithful. He did it over a span of time. God's not done with us yet. He works incrementally. And with little gain here and a little gain there, at some point when we are commissioned to take Isaac to the mountaintop, we either pass or fail the test. And God says, that's my daughter, that's my son, I can now, you know, I can count on them. Genesis 12, he forsook his homeland of Mesopotamia, his comfortable disposition in Ur of the Chaldees for an unknown destination. Genesis 13, he let go of proximity to Lot, the nephew, his sole family companion in a foreign land. Genesis 17, I didn't speak about, but has to do with Ishmael. Ishmael, his flesh and blood, yes, through Hagar, but anyone who has ever gone through the experience of losing a child through either death or other means of being prevented from access, you understand what that means and what it can be like and the agony that it can bring. And Abraham was approached by Sarah almost as soon as the deed was done. It was her idea. Again, that's something which you get a sense of grave frustration emanating from Abraham about. You brought Hagar in and told me this was the way to solve the problem. And in that ancient world culture, that was the way to solve the problem. Some of the ancient world manuscripts or tables and texts that have been unearthed show that if you solve the problem of barrenness by bringing in a woman from the outside and producing a child. Today we call it surrogate parenthood. And Mr. Dean, I don't know what the policy in United is on that. I guess we may not have a policy on it. But it's an example of doing things the world's way, and God sometimes lets us do that. He'll let us beat our head against a wall until we get tired and we hurt enough to stop it. And then we'll say, okay, now God, how is it that you told me we should do this? And we go forward. Genesis 22, the sacrifice of Isaac. Now, we are children of Abraham. If you'll turn over to John chapter 15, a passage we typically read around the time of Passover. This has a relevance, I think, to the issues that we're here to examine today and tomorrow. There were another group of people who were defined by Christ as friends. It was at the supper immediately prior to Christ's crucifixion. In John 15, beginning in verse 14, he looked at those who would soon become his apostles and he said, "You are my what? Friends. You are my friends if you do whatsoever I command you." And for those of us who are part of the Church of God, that's been a pivot point, hasn't it? We've chosen to do what God has commanded us. Christ goes on in verse 15, "Henceforth I call you not servants. A servant doesn't know what his Lord and Master does. Rather, I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you." By extension, we are a part of this group. These promises apply to you and me in 1998 as we sit here in the comfortable confines of this nice auditorium in Sydney. Now, God reveals what is to come to His people. We cannot, in a scientific way, put it in a test tube, measure it. We can't take it out to friends, relatives, neighbors, beat them over the head with it and say, "You must believe this," and make them understand what, by revelation of God, has been given to us. We have a responsibility to deliver the message. That's a separate issue. But we may wind up not being liked very well for what we have to say. Again, the subject of a different sermon. My point in this is, in an age where over the last 12 years, prophecy was progressively abandoned as a part of what we as the Church of God were about, or the churches of God, perhaps I should say, were about, we need to be very careful not to cut that tie. And I think it's high time for us to sharpen and increase our focus on this aspect of biblical teaching and understanding. Now, Meanwhile, picking up the thread of the promise, I want to talk a little bit more about that. Isaac, in Genesis 26, verses 1 through 5, Isaac is designated by God. He realizes that he is the inheritor of the Abrahamic promises. It goes from Abraham to him. From there, it's passed on to the second born of his two sons, Jacob. Jacob. Now, there is a, as we say in Texas, a real piece of work. Now, over the years in the church, I have done my dead level best to try and make this fellow look good. I'm sorry. I can't do it. Now, maybe in the instance of Genesis 25, the sale of the birthright, perhaps what we can do is at least grant some tolerance for what appears to me to be pretty much raw, crass, naked opportunism. You know, Esau, a man's man, coming into camp with one or two deer draped over his shoulder. He's exhausted from the hunt. This is a paraphrase. I'm not quoting directly, by the way, at this point. He's starved to death. Jacob, who has a much more gentle disposition, and by the way in which the Hebrew grammar appears in the Bible, it seems he is more given to treat people a little more decently. Jacob is cooking up, what, pottage? Lentil soup, I think was what it was. And Esau comes in and said, "Boy, that smells good. Give me some of that." And Jacob says, let's see, he also had a business sense. How am I going to make the best of this? This is falling into my lap. Okay, sure, you can have all the soup you want. I just want your birthright. And Jacob, or Esau, not being a particularly sharp businessman, says, sounds good to me. As I was reading this story to my son last year, last summer, one Sabbath, he looked up at me quizzically and said, "Dad, how come this guy Esau didn't just make his own soup?" Well, good question. But he didn't. And the birthright fell into the hands of the younger of the two twin boys. Now, if we can maybe be generous-hearted and forgiving to Jacob there, let's take a look at Genesis 27. Again, I'll paraphrase. That one is a little bit tougher to excuse. I mean, you're talking about outright, planned-ahead, malicious conspiracy. They go out and kill a couple of goats and strap them onto the boys' arms, which, as a sidelight, I might say, would certainly make Esau either the greatest candidate for a Schick razor blade commercial, or alternatively, poor old Isaac's tactile senses were so far deteriorated that it wouldn't have mattered much anyway. He goes in, he lies about this, which I would interject here. Again, ancient records tell us that an inheritance obtained by deceit was considered lawful in that culture and that day and age. He winds up stealing, in essence, you know, what Esau has left. And we're going to look at this guy and say, boy, that's a model of spiritual behavior that I'd sure like to get in line up behind and follow. Now, I don't know. I've read this story or these stories over the years, and it becomes very easy. And I want to interject something here, add to the story. It becomes easy for me, and I would imagine at least some others in God's church, to look at this and say, here's a guy who flagrantly pretty much wipes his feet on some of the basic spiritual principles of how we ought to treat each other. And God gives him the birthright. He gives him the blessing. Go figure. How do you explain that? Well, I think I can. Now I'm imposing my interpretation on Scripture, but I feel fairly comfortable in doing this. It's like Hagar, Sarah, and Abraham. No sooner than they got outside God's law and did it the world's way, problems just begin to engulf these people. What happens after the deceit? Esau comes back into camp and said, "I'm here. Give me the blessing." "Who is this?" Isaac says. "Well, sorry, but it's already been given. I can only give you some leftover stuff." And Esau said, "Oh, shucks, Dad, that sounds all right. I'm happy to have what's left over." Now, that's not what Scripture says, is it? He began plotting to kill his brother. I know how to fix that. We'll kill Jacob. He won't have any descendants, and that everything goes back to me. Now, there's a good worldly way of solving a problem. What happened to Jacob? Well, in Texas, we'd say he got out of Dodge. He left. He hightailed it. He went back to Mesopotamia, where the family estate was. And wouldn't you know it, about the time he pulls into town, you know, out to, I think, watering his camels. Out walks, you know, Oda B. Young again. And the hormones are running at 180 kilometers an hour. He sees this beautiful young thing, and he has got to have her for his wife. Laban says, sure, we can work out a deal. 7 years of labor, Jacob, being controlled more by hormones than brains, says, sounds good, sign on the dotted line, let's do this. Carry it forward 7 years. Big wedding feast, great celebration, and I can only assume there were vast quantities of alcohol consumed. Into the wedding tent. He wakes up the next morning, and it's like Kevin in Home Alone. You're not Rachel! Leah, who put you here? Do you suppose that it might have gone through his mind? Now, I know I'm imposing an interpretation on Scripture, but I feel pretty safe in doing this. Might Jacob have thought, oh, so that's how it feels. Now I understand what I did to somebody else. Twice. Now, in the story that we're going to sketch, which is pretty much raw, unvarnished, carnal, secular history, with a Sherrod spin put on it in terms of where God may have intervened here and there, and quite frankly, quite often, we're going to see a lot of things that aren't going to be done necessarily God's way. Treaties that weren't entirely fair to various people, peace settlements, wars, all kinds of unseemly things that are way outside the boundaries of the Ten Commandments. Does that mean that we need to line up behind it and do it that way? No. It just means, I think, for the broad stretch of 6,000 years, most people haven't been really acquainted with God's ways, and if they have, they haven't been able, by lack of having the Spirit of God to empower them, they haven't obeyed those laws. And we have Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and all the other cities around the world that have all the problems that we see today because we refuse as humanity to do what we should have done way back at the beginning in the Garden of Eden. That's a time-honored pattern of behavior. Now, you can go on to Genesis 35, verses 9 through 12, and you find that ultimately God indeed confirms the blessings going to Jacob. He worked with Jacob, just like he worked with Abraham, and by the end of the story, Jacob has straightened up and is headed in a direction which God can use. Verse 11 is an interesting verse, particularly as we sit here in the midst of, with Elizabeth's imperious gaze down upon us, a part of the Commonwealth world. It's the first instance we see that phrase, a company of nations. We'll see it again here in a moment. Now, for me, the heart of the matter, and I don't know what you came here expecting to hear, but I will play to my strengths rather than speaking about things that I don't have as much experience in speaking about. For me, the proof of Israel is prophecy. It's not in some academic form massing together facts, most of which are subject to varying interpretations with relatively equal plausibility. That's what keeps historians in business. One will amass a set of facts and propose a theory or thesis about this is why and how this happened, and then someone at a university across the way will mass similar or different facts, and then they will spend the next three decades hurling those facts back at one another. That's what drives academe forward. I've been there. I know that. I've been a part of it to one degree or another. I would submit to you that, at least for me, the most convincing aspect of this is prophecy. Prophecy in retrospect, and that's what I'll focus on during my stay here in Sydney. Looking back over the sweep of history and seeing where and how various prophecies about the ascendancy of the Israelitish people have occurred, and prophecy in prospect, looking ahead, and I won't take time, at least while I'm here in Sydney or the other cities, the venues, to talk much about this. I know Mr. Dean alluded to it, but I'm going to focus more on the retrospective view. Prospect. You cannot read the Old Testament prophecies and say that God does not clearly declare that there is a bad time coming. We've already seen some scriptures about that today. That there's going to be a time of Jacob's trouble, and the descendants at the end of the age are going to be engulfed in problems the likes of which you ain't never seen before. Happily, there are predictions as well that there's going to be a restoration. One which in a few places in the prophetic books clearly inform us that the second coming Exodus is going to be so monumental and magnificent that it's going to dwarf into insignificance the first Exodus. That's pretty big stuff. I don't know how prophecy is best interpreted with hindsight, and maybe that's why I'll focus on hindsight as we work our way through some of the material later today. Genesis 48 is an interesting passage. Let's just turn over there and take a moment or two to look at that. Genesis 48, we find the patriarch Jacob summoning Joseph, asking him to bring his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, on whom he will pronounce various blessings. Now, in the first instance, he, in essence, adopts these two young men. Jacob knew his sons. I mean, they were, after all, those fellows who took Joseph and threw him down in the pit. And he knew that it wasn't beyond them at some later point to act in a similar fashion. That once Jacob died, there could be all kinds of claims and charges made suggesting that Judah should have the promise. No, Judah shouldn't. Simeon, no. Levi, no. Reuben, no. You fill in the blank. Verse 5, and now your two sons, Jacob speaks, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born unto you in the land of Egypt before I came, these are mine. And notice the replacement value. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Reuben and Simeon were the first two offspring of the union between Jacob and Leah. Now, Jacob has two firstborns in the story that we'll sketch today. Keep that concept in the back of your mind. We'll touch on it here in a moment. I think one thing, and many of the commentaries make this point, I think one thing that was of immense concern to Jacob was that once he was gone, if this pronouncement had not been made, that the charge would be leveled. Ephraim and Manasseh cannot inherit a promise to Semitic seed. Who was the mother of Ephraim and Manasseh? She was the daughter of the prince of On, out of the Egyptian aristocracy. I know the King James Version says the priest, but more recent corrected versions will say prince. Verse 16, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless these lads. Let my name be named upon them and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac. Let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And I believe that's happened. Verse 19, his father refused. This is the crossed arms. He said, I know it, my son. I know what I'm doing. And he, meaning Manasseh, shall also become a people. He also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater. He and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. There's nothing in the record of human history, anything like the British Commonwealth of Nations. It included Anglo-Saxons, but it also had a reach that at its peak in, I think, 1933, exercised governmental control over a quarter of the world's population. As I'll talk to you in the last presentation tomorrow, it is a forerunner. It is the kingdom of God, of Jesus Christ on earth in microcosm, bringing in all peoples. And that, of course, is a forerunner, a type, if you will, of what ultimately the literal spirit-born kingdom of God will be. Now, in the progression, we've left out a fairly significant figure. Turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 5. You notice we skipped a generation, namely that of Joseph. For those of you, by the way, who have intractable problems with insomnia, 1 Chronicles chapters 1 through 12 comes highly recommended. So-and-so begets so-and-so begets so. It can put you under fairly quickly. However, interspersed amongst these begettals, occasionally we find some pretty important information. And verses 1 and 2 in 1 Chronicles 5 certainly is to be included here. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, and then inserted from here through verse 2 is a parenthetical thought, but it's critical for what we will be looking at and examining in these coming presentations. For he was the firstborn in that union between Jacob and Leah. But he made some mistakes, for as much as he defiled his father's bed, he went to bed and had intercourse with Bilhah, one of the concubines of Jacob. And God took that seriously. He defiled his father's bed, and his birthright as a result was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, the second of the two firstborns. And the genealogy then is not to be reckoned after the birthright. In any other word, by right of primogeniture, the firstborn male offspring getting a double portion.